Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
With pharmacies around New York closing at high rates, local advocates are trying to pass legislation to revitalize the industry. The Legislative Gazette's Sam Dingman with more.
Jared Nikos and his family have been in the pharmacy business since the 1950s. As he and his uncles like to say,
it's a lifestyle. It really is. It's a very difficult, rewarding, of course, but it's a very difficult task.
Jared's talking specifically about the lifestyle of running an independent pharmacy. His family owns five of them, including Nikos Dedrick's Pharmacy in Kingston. That's the location Jared's been running since earlier this year, when his uncle decided he didn't want to do it anymore.
My uncle was looking for a new role because of the, you know, pressures that are being applied, outside pressures.
The pressures Jared's talking about have to do with PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers. Those are the companies that handle prescriptions for health insurance companies. Three of them, Caremark, Optum, and Express Scripts, manage between 80 and 90% of all prescriptions in the United States. Caremark is owned by CVS, which also owns Aetna Healthcare. Optum is a subsidiary of United Healthcare, and Express Scripts is owned by another health insurance company, Cigna. That gives those three PBMs extraordinary control over the pricing and distribution of prescription medications. And for years now, independent pharmacies have been complaining that those three companies are reimbursing them at below market rates. Kelly McMahon is the executive director of the Pharmacists Society of the State of New York. I spoke to her Wednesday at a rally about prescription pricing at the state capitol. She told me pharmacies that aren't affiliated with the so-called big three just can't compete.
For example, if it costs them $100 to purchase a prescription, they're being reimbursed $80. So they're losing money to fill that prescription, and pharmacies are closing at an alarming rate.
Case in point, says Jared Nikos, lisinopril, a blood pressure medication.
You have something like lisinopril where you might make 20 cents on it, and that doesn't even cover the cost of the vial, the label, and then you throw in labor, overhead, you know, it leaves the store at a $7 or $8 loss by the time you incorporate all the other expenses associated with dispensing that medication.
As Kelly mentioned, pharmacies around the country have been going out of business. A recent study in Health Affairs, a policy research journal, found that nearly 30% of the pharmacies that opened between 2010 and 2020 had closed. During the three-year period between 2018 and 2021, more pharmacies closed than opened. And it's not just small, independent pharmacies shutting down. Rite Aid, which was a major chain, but did not have that vertical integration with a PBM, closed all of its stores last year. One of them was just down the road from Jared Nikos' pharmacy in Kingston. On the one hand, he told me, that was great. New customers are always welcome. But on the other hand, a lot of those customers needed prescriptions that are managed by the PBMs.
Now we're, you know, losing big money on a lot of their scripts. It's a very interesting business.
For now, Jared and his family's pharmacies have been able to stay afloat by competing at the service level. Nikos stores, he says, are the kind of place where your pharmacist knows your name.
People seek us out specifically because they're looking for a higher level of care. People really need to feel like a human being, not just a number, not just a serialized transaction where pushing them out the door to get the next person in.
He also thinks indie pharmacies have another advantage, accessibility.
You can literally just walk in and talk to us and get, you know, a consultation, recommendations, immunization, all within, you know, 5 to 10 minutes and no appointment necessary in most places and times.
Jared is a supporter of the bill that Kelly McMahon was at the Capitol to rally for yesterday, the Patient Access to Pharmacy Act, or PAPA, as its supporters call it. If passed, it would guarantee a minimum reimbursement level for pharmacies around the state.
So this bill asks for the Medicaid rate. No other company or organization is coming in asking for the Medicaid rate because it's so low, but that'll be a step up for these pharmacists. And so we're asking.
The PAPA bill has passed through the state Senate. It's currently being debated in the Assembly. This is actually the second year it's passed through the Senate, and Jared is hoping this is the year it finally becomes law.
You know, the industry in general really needs some, really needs a little bit of a transformation in order to make sure that we have plenty of longevity and we're not going to be replaced by, you know, a few gargantuan dispensers.
New York's legislative session ends June 4th. I reached out to Caremark, Optum, and Express Scripts for comments on this story, but did not receive a reply. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Sam Dingman.
Upstate transit agencies say additional funding in this year's state budget should help avoid major service cuts. But as Samuel King with the New York Public News Network reports, lawmakers will push for more funding in future years.
Upstate transit agencies had sought a 15% increase in operating dollars, but ended up with a 7% increase. Miguel Velasquez is CEO of the Rochester-based Regional Transit Service and president of the New York Public Transit Association. He says agencies are dealing with rising costs as demand grows.
Our communities are all asking for more and better service. And so once we're able to maintain that financial stability, then is what are the services that we can improve upon to meet that demand?
Senate Transportation Committee Chairman Jeremy Cooney is from Rochester. He calls this year's budget a step in the right direction, but says more investment is needed.
I'm still a little frustrated because I'd like to see us truly invest in public transit outside of New York City.
The budget also included capital funding for the addition of Yates County to RTS and for Metrorail in Buffalo. In Albany, I'm Samuel King for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Chris Ketsley, Executive Director of the New York Association of Towns. We spoke about the need for more funding to cover unfunded mandates.
Well, that's what we continually fight against, and sometimes the unfunded mandates aren't necessarily obvious. You know, a lot of it is with things that they put on towns that they have to do that they wouldn't otherwise do. You know, it could be anything from sweeping roads. It could be anything from, very often the state uses local government as an administrative arm, whether right or wrong. For example, you know, a mandate on a town might be that they are the MS4, Stormwater Management Enforcement Agency, but they're all regs that come from the state of New York. And so state of New York makes all these arduous, overburdensome regulations and then puts it on the town and says, well, you guys got to enforce it, so good luck. Means the town usually has to hire an MS4 officer that they wouldn't normally hire. And this is true throughout a lot of operations. You know, the building department, building code. Building code is a New York State code. It's not a town-specific code. But those building inspectors have to comply with all the complexities that New York State puts on them. So there's clear mandates, and then there's kind of like these more quiet mandates that are operational and not necessarily seen, but they do add, they drive to the budget, the cost of the budget.
Well, an issue that I know you guys are very supportive of and want to make sure you preserve, and this has been around for a long, long time, which is home rule. I mean, I think this is something that often intersects between the local village, town, and city and the state government. But the idea of allowing those closest to the issues rule those issues.
So this is the heart, really. You're getting to the heart of what the association is all about. It's really about protecting and advancing the purpose of home rule. And home rule, we think, is important. We think home rule is what this nation was built on, right? Whether you're railing against the King of England or you're railing against Albany, decisions should not be made in outside the communities that they're affecting to the extent possible. we all know that there's certain things that are statewide concerns or federal concerns or, you know, larger concerns. But generally speaking, home rule, the folks who live in the community know what's best for the community, know how they want their community to, you know, be set up. And they are the ones that should determine what happens in the community. And we're very strong on that, very clear on that. And every issue we really put through the prism of home rule, you know, and you're seeing it in energy policy today. You're seeing it in housing policy. You're seeing a lot of issues where the state is creeping dangerously too far into trampling on home rule.
So to sort of encapsulate this, this is a constant battle that happens, right? Because the state is forever, even when it may benefit. So you've got like the environmental review laws and other laws, you know, zoning laws and things like that that are important to those in the home municipality, but that the government will constantly, through their proposals and attempts to, quote, solve problems, end up creating more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see it with these super huge solar installations that they're putting in these, I think there's 18 of them now across the state in rural areas in particular that is going through ORES, which is a state agency, a bureaucratic state agency, not accountable to any voter. And they make the determination of what's going to happen in these communities. And they're doing it over the objection of the community. And that is just wrong. That is not something that our democracy is built on. And you can wrap anything in a good cause, right? Well, we need more energy on the grid, and we need clean energy and this kind of stuff. But shoving it down local government's throats where people do not want to deforest or do not want to, harm their land is just wrong. And we're seeing more and more of that we're pushing back against. Battery storage installations, that's another one. You know, this is new, and you're seeing a lot of public safety concerns. But when the state says, well, we don't care about the public safety concerns in your community, we need this and we want this and it's going to happen. That is just wrong. That's not what our republic was built on. And I think, you know, the 250th anniversary of our founding is a good time for us to sit down and think about home rule and really what our principles are about. And it is about making sure that we govern from the bottom up, not the top down. And that's what we continue to fight for.
We're speaking with Chris Ketsley, Executive Director of the New York Association of Towns, and you can find out more at nytowns.org. Now, we started with the idea that in the budget there is some increase in the aid to municipalities, but that it's really not enough. And I've talked with others, including the state comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, about how in so many ways the salaries, the pensions, and the aid has not kept up with inflation. And you can track that back to the 50s. But you said, well, we're trying to come up with some ideas to make up the gap. So maybe we could go there now. What are some of the ideas you guys are coming up with to try to ease the burden on towns?
Well, first of all, from a town perspective, we're asking the legislature and the governor's office to give towns parity with their sister communities, counties, and cities, and allow them to start by right looking at other revenue streams so it takes the pressure off the property tax owner. Now, we say this to understand how efficient governments are, town governments in particular. Very often, when you look at your annual property tax dollar that you pay over the course of the year, usually 10 to 15% of it is a town tax. The rest of it is county, school, you know, another tax. School taxes really take up the largest portion. And so we run very efficiently on very little. The levy is somewhat smaller on towns than it is in other governments. But that said, it can't continue. There's a breaking point where we can't just keep going back to the levy to deal with what you just talked about, wage increases every year, health insurance. If we need a whole nother show just to talk about health, yes. I mean, health insurance costs grow at 10, 12, 15% a year for local governments, and there's nothing that the state is doing to help us deal with that. So I think it's a two-way approach. We need to find more revenue or diversify our revenue, but also, we need the state to come in and allow us to do things to help cut these costs. The state basically makes towns stay in the health insurance that they have and take the increase and not deploy any strategies to try to mitigate that increase down a little bit. Those are things that are broken in the state. And those are the things that we're going to continue to try to fight for, even after the budget. And we know session is ending soon, like probably tomorrow or the next day. But we're going to stay at it all summer long with the legislators.
That's Chris Ketsley, Executive Director of the New York Association of Towns. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. With us is Maha Ahmed, the senior editor at New York Focus. Welcome, Maha.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's very interesting because what you've done at New York Focus, and you can head to nysfocus.com to find out more, is you've brought a searchable database to the New York state budget. Now, let me explain. There's a $269 billion state budget that was approved and signed by the governor last week. There are all these issues: fiscal, education, social services, child care, climate and environment, criminal justice, immigration, on and on and on, where there is more to learn. And you've allowed the public to look at this database now. Again, at nysfocus.com. And let's start, if we could, Maha, with the big issue this year, which was the governor of New York and the mayor of New York City in sort of a face-off where they came to what would be considered a compromise.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani had really made tax the rich a big rallying cry of his campaign last year. He came in wanting a tax hike on New York's top earners. That was his big ticket item. He didn't get that, but he did get billions of dollars from the state to plug a hole in the city's budget, and, you know, some new funding for childcare, as well as the big new tax of a tax on luxury second homes in New York City. But ultimately, he, you know, wasn't able to get the big tax that he wanted on the ultra wealthy of New York.
Now let's turn to your database. You've got thousands of pages of documents in this guide, and people can kind of go through over these subheads and click on them to learn more. Let's just take one, a big one this year: climate and environment.
Yes, exactly. So I think the climate negotiations were one of the most interesting and telling pieces of the negotiations, and a great example of, you know, the enormous power that the governor wields in the budget process, and just a crazy example of how drastically things can change over the course of a couple months. You know, at the beginning of the budget season, there were no changes to the law really officially on the table, and then, you know, lawmakers made it pretty clear that they opposed any potential changes. And then by the end, you know, Governor Kathy Hochul successfully dismantled key parts of the law, the big climate law from 2019. And so, you know, I think that was one of the key areas that had been holding up budget negotiations and why they were almost 2 months late, and also why now lawmakers have, as of, you know, Wednesday, there's just one more day left in the legislative session. It ends on Thursday. And so, we've kind of ended up in a pretty drastic example of the pattern and dynamic that the governor has established with the legislature.
We sure have. And I'll note that the law, the climate law, had to be changed if they couldn't meet the deadline for what was in the law. They'd be breaking the law, which is why the governor pushed for it. But it sort of all came down to last minute. What choice do we have? She is Maha Ahmed, senior editor at New York Focus. And you can read all about this and more at nysfocus.com. Maha, can't thank you enough for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The Republican candidates running for their party's nomination in the race for New York's 21st congressional district are trading barbs as early voting approaches. Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine reports.
Ahead of a planned candidate forum with New York State Assemblyman Robert Smullen, it wasn't clear if his opponent, Amsterdam businessman Anthony Constantino, would show. And at the end of the event that morphed into a contentious debate, Smullen declined to shake Constantino's hand. As he seeks the seat held by Republican Elise Stefanik, Smullen continued his attacks against anti-establishment Constantino during an event Tuesday in Albany.
Is he going to bring sex predators and accused murderers into a congressional office where they interact with your family members and your neighbors who come looking for help? Is he going to send threatening messages to constituents who disagree with how he votes? Is he going to try to intimidate elderly veterans who speak their minds? These are not hypothetical questions. We have already seen the answers. We have seen them in writing. We have seen them in court documents. We have seen them on the internet for the world to read.
Smullen shared a text message he received from Constantino in the days leading up to last week's debate. It reads, in part, quote, "There was a point in time where I felt bad for you and wanted to be nice when you lose. But I have since learned that you are a truly evil person that I must protect America from," unquote. Reached by WAMC Tuesday, Constantino called Smullen's latest attacks recycled and debunked. The Sticker Mule CEO has called Smullen, a retired Marine Corps colonel, names like Slime Bob, Swampling, and a Rhino, short for Republican in name only. The race has become enigmatic of the national debate in Republican politics. Smullen, who has represented the 118th New York State Assembly District since 2019, has received the support of the New York Republican State Committee and a majority of the county GOP committees in the sprawling 21st Congressional District. Constantino has received an endorsement from President Donald Trump. Constantino has flattered the president with a musical album, a bronze sculpture of the 45th and 47th president, and a massive sign atop his Amsterdam businesses asking residents to vote for Trump. Smullen has accused Constantino and Sticker Mule of profiting off of anti-police and anti-Semitic stickers. At last week's debate, hosted by WRGB CBS 6, Constantino responded to Smullen's accusations.
"We let people sell things on Sticker Mule. People have uploaded over close to 200,000 designs. They can upload anything they want. We're going to implement AI soon to block things that go against our guidelines. But if you see something that goes against our guidelines, you just have to click report listing. Instead of clicking report listing, he promotes it. He uses his own campaign funds to promote horrible stickers that I want nothing to do with."
At a campaign event last month, Constantino announced he was filing two complaints linked to alleged misuse and incomplete disclosure of campaign funds. As the Republican primary approaches, Smullen maintains he's the man for the job.
"I will be on the ballot in November. I will win the Republican primary on June 23rd.
As Smullen touts his endorsements, Constantino recently criticized his opponent for his endorsement from New York's largest teachers union, New York State United Teachers, in 2024.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello Levine. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. One of New York City's most common birds is the black-crowned night heron, a very loud wading bird. But ornithologists say that the nocturnal avian could disappear from the Big Apple in 10 years without conservation efforts. The New York Public News Network's Rosemary Misdery reports.
New York City is home to the largest population of black-crowned night herons in the Northeast.
Black-crowned night heron are kind of like the quintessential New Yorker. They are these cool-looking birds that like to stay out late.
They're like little dinosaurs, and they'll chase you with their beak and try to go after you, so they're pretty feisty.
Dustin Partridge and Shannon Curley are avian ecologists at the New York City Bird Alliance. Every year, they survey the birds in the wetlands and islands around the city. Over the past two decades, they say the number of the red-eyed raptors has decreased by 55%. The cause of the decline is unknown, but there are theories.
These birds are facing climate change, loss of habitat. There's also an increase of mammalian predators.
Like raccoons.
Some of the raccoons actually probably take the subway tracks in Jamaica Bay. The subway runs right through, so they have kind of a land bridge to get there. These islands are also prone to a lot of disturbance, boat traffic, and people coming to the islands, and potentially contaminants in their foraging areas.
Curley says conserving the long-legged fowl could save other species from potential extinction.
Black-crowned night herons are just not another bird species in the harbor. These are indicator species and telling us something about environmental health. And their decline may be an early indicator, early warning sign.
Ecologists say it's not too late to save the scrappy heron. The next step is to pinpoint the cause of their struggle and keep them thriving in New York City Harbor. In New York City, I'm Rosemary Misdery for the New York Public News Network.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Just look for program number 2623. And join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.